Hi, my name is Perry Cohen. I'm CEO of the Pharmacy Group, and it's my pleasure to continue to host Conversations with Perry and Friends for Managed Healthcare Executive. Our first episode, we talked about the role of government in healthcare, and this episode, we're going to talk about the role of employers in healthcare. And there's no better person that I can think of than my good friend Paul Fronston, who's the Director of Health Benefits Research from the Employee Benefits Research Institute, better known as EBRI, based in Washington, D.C. Paul and I have been good friends for over 20 years. And whenever I have a question about what the hell's going on in the employer market, I just call Paul. He's got all the information and he's got the data to back it up. So in this world of misinformation, I figure that Paul is the truth. So Paul, can you share a bit about your background on yourself and tell us what the Employee Benefit Research Institute is?
Yes, it's great to be with you, Perry. Thank you so much for including me in your podcast series. I'm honored to be one of your friends. So let me talk real quick about the Employee Benefit Research Institute before I talk about myself. EBRI is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization based in Washington, D.C. We're not a lobbying organization. We don't take positions on policy. We're a membership organization. Our membership is a very diverse group that allows us to maintain our credibility in DC. EBRI started in 1973. I joined EBRI in 19, I'm sorry, EBRI started in 1978. I joined EBRI in 1993. And I came here from the University of Miami, where I got a PhD in economics. At the time, my specialties were labor and health economics, which made me a perfect fit for doing research on health insurance in the workplace, which I've been doing ever since. And now I'm director of the Health Benefits Research Program at EBRI.
Okay, so when we talk about health insurance, I think we need to frame it a little bit in the United States. According to some recent articles I've read, there's about 330 million people in the United States. These 330 million people need health care, and most of them need health insurance because they can't afford it on their own. Of that, 216 million have private health insurance. That's about two-thirds of that total, so it's a big group. And the rest, the other third, is either covered by government health programs, which are Medicaid and Medicare, commonly known, and the marketplace nowadays. And then the last group is the 26 million uninsured. So this is really the big dog that drives change, from my view, in healthcare, because if they pay for it, we'll do it. So with that background, Paul, can you tell us, give us an overview of the landscape of the employment-based system?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's the most common source of coverage in the US, even when you combine Medicare and Medicaid together. And landscape is complicated. Unlike the landscape for Medicare and Medicaid, which are social insurance programs, they're, I don't want to say they're straightforward, but they're more straightforward than this employment-based system that I would say has many landscapes. It's the landscape by firm size. You've got larger employers, you've got smaller employers. There's a landscape when it comes to how plans are funded, whether they're self-insured and fully insured. And for those who don't know, self-insurance means an employer basically acts like their own insurance company. And a fully insured plan, like at EBRI, where we're a small business, we buy insurance from a insurance company. Just some key stats. Larger employers are much more likely to offer health benefits than smaller ones. In fact, almost all large employers do. Larger employers are much more likely to be self-insured than smaller employers. And I would argue that larger employers are often the drivers of innovation. And that innovation trickles out to the rest of the market. You'll see insurance companies adopt what employers are experimenting with. You'll even see Medicare adopted at times. Things like consumer-driven healthcare and transparency, navigation tools, tiered provider networks, centers of excellence, digital health, maybe fertility benefits. You're starting to see a lot of different point solutions that employers are wrestling with. But even in the larger employer community, most aren't large enough to affect change. They need to rely on their health insurers for leverage. There are some larger employers who are enlightened. They're the ones who are active. They're the ones who are innovative. They're the leaders. They're vocal about what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what they hope to get out of it. And sometimes they actually talk about what they find. They like to share their stories, but most employers are followers. I think one thing to keep in mind about the landscape, and this is another place where you could divide it into two, employers don't have to offer coverage. They do so voluntarily. There's a mandate, the ACA, that they do, but employers were offering coverage long before that. That's not the reason why they got into it. In fact, it's much less costly for them to drop coverage and pay the penalty, but they still seem to have this paternalistic attitude and feel that they need to offer benefits to be competitive in the labor market and to have a positive impact on the health and productivity of their workers and families. And it matters that employment-based coverage is most common because of the influence and because of policy relevance. It's hard to make a move at the national health level on health reform without an impact on the 180 million people that are touched by employment-based coverage.
So we've got employers out there that decided to do coverage, ACA aside, and all that type of thing. And then there's something where they're either self-insured or they buy fully insured products from the marketplace. Break that down for me, the 65% that are have health insurance, self-insured versus fully insured.
Yeah, you start off by saying that I know all the, I have the data to back things up, but I don't remember every number, right?
Okay.
It's something like 70 plus percent of larger employers, and I'm defining large as like 1,000 or more employees, so they're,
Okay,
not
1,000 or
even the
more
jumbo,
employees. Okay.
are self-insured or self-insuring at least one plan. Sometimes they'll offer a mix of self-insured, national self-insured, and local fully insured plans. Whereas you get to the small and medium, you're talking about numbers in the teens, right?
So with this trend towards self-insurers, does that mean they use TPAs to administer the benefits
Well,
versus an insurance company?
in most cases, they're using a TPA or an insurance company. They're using someone to be the administrator. The employer is the one at risk, but the insurance company is doing the work on their behalf. They're leveraging the insurance company's negotiated rates. They're leveraging their ability to process claims. You get a card from the insurance company. If you're an employee of one of these firms, there's a good chance you don't even know what the terms self-insured and fully insured are, right? It looks and feels like a fully insured
Yeah.
plan, with the difference being larger employers benefit from the law of large numbers, such that they could act like their own insurance company.
So, is there a trend of employers, regardless of their size, moving more to self-insurance
Interestingly,
versus
the
insured
trend,
product?
and this is something that I need to dig into more, the trend is that since the ACA passed, you're seeing more small and medium-sized companies moving towards self-insurance. I mean, we're not seeing gigantic jumps, right? The numbers are still small.
Right.
But they're creeping up. And among larger employers, you're actually seeing the numbers creep down over a long period of time, but they're still really high. I'm not sure what's going on in the large employer market yet. That's something that's been on our agenda to dig into. On the small and medium size, I think what's going on there is we're not seeing a bigger jump because they'll be convinced to, by a broker or somebody to go into, a self-insured plan. And a lot of them are going to have a bad experience, right? One claim is going to
Right.
be a bad year. And then they go back to being fully insured. So I'm seeing the numbers over time, but I'm not really seeing the churn within those numbers to give me a sense of how many small and medium-sized employers have experimented with it and backed off.
So why would an employer so I'm an employer, I have a fully insured product now, I'm 1500 life, account. Why would I do self-insure? What's
Your
my criteria?
premiums went up 25%,
Okay, so
right?
premiums
You're
went up
looking,
high. I want to own it more.
you want to own it more. You want some more cost certainty. I'm not sure it gets you that. You just want to reduce what you think you're going to spend the following year. I used to, many years ago, there was a local employer here, 200 employees. They were self-insured. And the way they went about budgeting for it was, and their attitude, it was really a budgeting attitude. Said, if we go into the year thinking we're going to have three large claims, if we have three, we're good. If we have two, hey, it's a better than average year. If we have four, oops, it costs us more. But on
Right.
average, we're going to hit three, and they could live with that, kind of like riding the ups and downs of the stock market. But the smaller you get, a lot of employers that are self-insured, especially the smaller ones, buy stop loss coverage, reinsurance to protect themselves against large claims. But ultimately, those premiums are going to be driven by their experience. So, it'll catch up to them.
So it seems like historically, health benefits were under the human resources department. It was to keep people happy, keep people, healthy, that kind of stuff. How much is it driven by the CFO these days, the chief financial officer, that it's, he said, look at the numbers are too high. I'm taking this underneath it. It's a labor market be damned. I'm just going to cut.
I hear mixed stories. I hear that some CFOs are getting very involved and others still have a hands-off approach, and it's the benefits department that has the budget and they're dealing with it.
Okay. All right. So that leads to the next area we need to talk about, the cost of healthcare, right? What the cost is, right? There's quality, access, and cost. It's all about cost because we can measure it. What is driving up the cost of healthcare among workers and families these days?
And tend keep in mind that we tend to use the terms cost, spending, and prices interactively
Okay.
when they're really different, right? Workers see premiums and cost sharing. That's not necessarily the cost of healthcare. It's the cost of healthcare to them,
Right.
but that's not the total cost. So when you're focusing on the cost of healthcare, it's driven by healthcare providers. It's ultimately driven by what hospitals charge, what physicians charge, and what pharmacy manufacturers charge, labs charge. What's the cost of a hip, right?
Right.
What's the cost of a surgery for a hip, right?
Right.
So that's what determines the cost. And there are a number of reasons why cost or prices are going up, thereby driving up premiums and overall spending. Consolidation's a big driver of cost. Hospitals have been buying up hospitals. They've been buying up physician practices. Physicians have been merging with other physician groups. Everyone in the supply chain of providing healthcare services is getting bigger, which gives them more negotiating power over employers if they're negotiating with employers, but more so over insurance companies who would negotiate on behalf of an employer, whether they're fully insured or self-insured. And then you've got all the, medical miracles of modern medicine, R&D and imaging and pharmaceuticals, which drives up costs. Focus on rare diseases drives up costs because there aren't a lot of, other than GLP-1s, right? There's not a lot of people to spread these costs over if you're looking
Right.
at, a gene therapy, for instance. The bottom line, if you remember Uwe Reinhardt, a famous professor at Princeton, he would say it's the prices, and then he would add the word stupid. Right? He would say it's the prices, stupid. And in some sense, he's got that right. If you look at some of the recent studies, and one of my favorite ones is a study done every year by the Healthcare Cost Institute. I wish it was my study, so I like it so much. And it shows that spending or cost increases are being driven by price increases. Where utilization has been in large part flat. So we aren't using more. I think employers have figured out through plan design how to control increases in usage, but we're spending more.
Okay. With rising costs, have the employers moved more of the cost onto the employees? Cost sharing, benefit design?
Interestingly, it depends upon how you measure it. If you take the whole pie of what we spend on healthcare, employers and employees are basically paying the same slice. But the pie is getting bigger,
Okay.
right?
All
So it
right.
feels like people are paying more, and they are, and they might be paying more relative to their income, but they're not paying more relative to the total size of the pie.
Okay. With the aging of the population, we have multi-generational workforces. We've got people in their 60s who are one way, then we have people in their 40s and 50s, then we have the other generations that are younger. That's a dynamic, right? The who is the workforce, how they view technology, how they view to get their health care. So it feels like we're going from employees being patients of the delivery system, doing what they're told, to consumers of the delivery system and driving the bus. What's the role of an employer to manage this change? from patients to
Yeah.
consumers.
Yeah, it's a complicated role because they do have multi-generations with different needs. But older people like you and me are going to embrace technology just as much as younger people. In fact, maybe more because we're more likely to have health conditions, right? We're going to
Okay.
bet, we may benefit it from it more today than a younger person will, maybe 10, 15, 20 years before they really benefit from it. But I think as patients increasingly take on the role of consumers and are expected to make informed choices about their care, they have to weigh the cost and seek the value. Employers are going to continue to play a pivotal role in this transformation, and they need to. And maybe it's better to say a balanced role because the patient does not necessarily have medical expertise and shouldn't necessarily be expected to be their doc, their own doctor. The term skin in the game has been used for at least 20 years. And I say that employers need to play a balanced role because they could go too far in pushing workers to play Dr. Google.
Yeah.
So, right. So what could they do? They could be benefit design innovators. They could be the information gatekeeper and help people with care navigation services and decision support tools. They need to promote health literacy, not just literacy on getting health care, navigating health care, but also navigating health plan choices. And they're also going to continue to be the catalyst for market change, especially the large purchasers who are, the innovators, the leaders.
Okay. All right. And so, in this changing dynamic of employers, consumers, providers, it seems like in that triangle is something called a health plan. And with the changing balls in the air, what should a health plan do to stay relevant to employers in providing commercial health insurance?
Yeah, I think it almost doesn't matter whether it's small, fully insured plans or large self-insured plans. The things they have in common is that they don't have a lot of leverage. Even larger ones don't have as much leverage as they think, right? You could take a jumbo employer with 100,000 employees, and if you don't have a critical mass in some city, you're not going to be able to have leverage with the healthcare system in that area. So that's where the health plans come in. The employers need health plans to leverage on their behalf. They need them to provide information to workers and their families on not just cost, but quality, which they've started to do. They need to design plans to steer people to the best providers. To incentivize the high quality care and disincentivize the low quality care. And today, if you want to bring in what's happened in Washington, D.C., with the Make America Healthy Again movement, they need to figure out how to play in that arena better than they've been doing. For smaller employers, cost is the biggest issue. The numbers of smaller employers offering health coverage has fallen from historical highs. So how do businesses, how do health plans keep them around? How do they make it affordable? And especially in this environment now where you've got, on top of cost increases, you've got more general economic uncertainty and an environment of tariffs. Will that drive employers out of the market of offering coverage to smaller ones? The larger
Okay.
ones might start rethinking what they're doing as well. They've been
Yeah.
threatening to do so for like 30 years. They just haven't
Yeah,
taken the
right.
step.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's move from the macro down to one little item that I'm pretty close to is the drug issue, the pharmacy benefit, if you will. With increasing drug costs, we need new models to better manage these costs, whether it's cell and gene therapy, whatever. The market has changed, and PBMs, which really started about 30 years ago, from certain perspectives, have become like the dinosaur. They're like the established. So what's the next new thing? So what do employers want from their pharmacy benefit manager over the next 5 years?
I thought you said that was a little question.
It's a little niche. It's a little niche.
It's a
It's a
little
big
niche.
question and a little
So,
niche.
right. So I think with rising drug cost in particular from specialty meds and cell and gene therapies and now GLP-1s, employers are under growing pressure to control their pharmacy spend, but at the same time, they want to provide access and value for employees. So they're going to expect more from PBMs than just the transactional service model that they've been getting for, what'd you say, 30 years. In terms of more specifics, I think they want transparency and simplicity. They want some pass-through pricing models, so they get 100% of the rebates and the discounts are passed back to them. They want some alignment of incentives to reward value, such as things like improved adherence and outcomes, not just getting paid on volume. I think they want some help with formulary management for value as opposed to just volume. And interestingly, they're talking about things like support for outcomes-based models, where payments for high-cost drugs are tied to patient outcomes and long-term effectiveness. And I think that's something employers are going to look to their PBM to help facilitate and manage, and accountability and performance guarantees, pushing through service level guarantees, clinical and financial performance metrics. And then just basic help in terms of benefit tools and data integrations and analytics.
Okay, that's good. We'll take one more minute on the pharmaceutical piece. Let's just talk about GLP-1s for a second, whether it's Wegovy or Ozempic. It was the hot issue in 2024. It's going to be a maybe not as hot, but a pretty hot issue with our weight management stuff. So, how are employers grappling with coverage decisions and looking at the potential long-term implications for employee health and healthcare costs?
Another little question, right? This might be the biggest crossroad for employers right now. And it isn't as simple as what, we're both baseball fans. It isn't as simple as what Yogi Berra would tell them to do, which is when you come to a fork in the road, you take it. Coverage for the GLP-1 medications aren't just for diabetes management anymore. They're being used for weight loss. And that could yield returns, especially related to prevention, as well as conditions other than diabetes, such as cardiovascular disease, sleep apnea. I've even heard a rumor about using these medications to prevent Alzheimer's, which isn't really an employer issue, but it's interesting how the research on GLP-1s is developing. The evidence is that these drugs are clinically effective, but they're extremely costly. And that's creating a complex tension for employers between the short-term affordability and long-term value. And it, you know, they're rest you have a lot of employers that offer it for diabetes management, but are less so to offer it for obesity, but there's pressure to do so. And I think that, we'll see how that plays out, given the cost of the medications. And if there's cost changes, I could see more employers covering it. But they want to get, a return on their investment. And, as people leave, as their turnover, they see that, they're paying for something that some other employer is going to benefit from. But if they all do it, they all benefit. You just got to get there.
All right. So it's out there, it's moving. Let's talk about something that's happening new, and I won't say it's new and different, but with these pharma always wanting to get to the customer, whether it used to be the physician, get him to prescribe, get the employer to cover it, get to the patient to take it. Well, now we have the consumer. So I think whether it's direct-to-consumer advertising that's been around for the last 30 years, the next extension of that is how can a drug company have a direct relationship with the consumer and bypass everything that's out there? And just it's a drug company and the consumer. And are there any thoughts on the direct-to-consumer move by Lilly and Novo Nordisk, who make these GLP-1s? It seems like the direct-to-consumer would get employers off the hook. Were
Oh, it
they
sure does. Yeah,
okay?
and you're seeing that. You saw that to some degree with compounding pharmacies, right? Where there was a lot of direct to consumer, and people were paying less out of pocket than they might be through their employer plan if their employer covered it. And employers haven't really been talking about that, but it could get them off the hooks. And there have been other examples like that. That are more cosmetic, like LASIK eye surgery was a big one.
Yeah.
So this could be the question is willingness to pay, and what do you do about lower income people who can't
Yeah.
afford
Right.
whatever the
Exactly.
direct to consumer is, and do the Elis and the Novos step up and provide differential pricing
Yeah.
based on income, because they do have patient assistance programs for other
Yeah,
medications, and
exactly. Exactly.
they may get to that point too.
So employers may just take a pass on GLP-1s for weight management. They may cover it for diabetes if you have that diagnosis and let the marketplace do it and treat it almost like a cosmetic benefit that it's
I
like.
think what it means for now is it buys them some time to see how that
Okay.
plays out.
Okay, that's fair. All right, we're coming up on the time here. Let me just close with a couple things. I'd like to get your opinion on this. What are some of the biggest misconceptions employees have about their health coverage?
Lots of misconceptions. I'm not going to list all the ones that come to mind, but keep in mind that they often lead to poor plan choices, delayed care, and higher out-of-pocket expenses than people would otherwise have. Picking the lowest premium plan means it's the best deal. That's not necessarily true. Preventive care isn't covered unless I've met my deductible, right? That's not always true. An HSA is like an FSA, right? It has a use it or
Wait,
lose it rule.
what HSA stands for what?
Health savings account.
And what's an
People.
FSA?
Flexible spending account.
Okay. So
Um,
explain those a
so,
little bit. Yeah.
so most people are used to an FSA, a flexible spending account. You decide at the beginning of the year how much money to put into it. It goes in pre-tax, and you use it to reimburse yourself for out-of-pocket expenses. Whatever you don't use at the end of the year, you lose. Although there's a
Ooh.
little bit more flexibility on that than there was in the past.
Okay.
HSAs, now health savings accounts, have been around for a little over 20 years. And they're more flexible. There's no use it or lose it rule. You can invest the money. There's more flexibility on how you contribute to it. You actually have until April 15th to contribute to the prior ca calendar year or prior tax year. And they're a lot different. And maybe 25% of the working population is in a plan with an HSA.
Do you have an
And
HSA?
I do.
Okay. Is it worthwhile?
For me, it's a great option. That doesn't mean it's a great option for everybody, right? It's
Okay.
a personal decision. And I think you
Right.
have to weigh, it goes back to which plan is the lowest premium plan the best plan,
Okay. All right. Here's another question. Do you see any big changes coming from employee benefit for employee benefits from the Trump administration?
I think so. That's most of their focus has been on Medicaid.
Right.
I think that there are two things to look out for. One is that you've got this tax bill that they're
Right.
trying to pay for through reduced spending in Medicaid. Does the tax treatment of employment-based coverage get
Ooh.
drawn into that somehow? Because it is the
Ooh.
biggest tax expenditure in the budget. So
Okay.
that's one to keep in mind. And two, ICHRAs, Individual Coverage Health Reimbursement Arrangements, which is just a fancy name for a way that employers could give workers money on a pre-tax basis to go buy insurance on their own. That's something the Trump administration came out with a rule on during the first administration to encourage employers to do so, to make it easier to do so. It could work because of the ACA marketplaces. So this is something to look for. If the Trump administration, if they ever got their repeal of the ACA, you couldn't do ICHRAs, right? You kind of need the exchanges and the insurance market
Oh, I see.
reforms that go along with that to do ICHRAs. And we
Okay.
haven't heard anything out of the administration yet about ICHRAs yet, but we might,
Okay.
right? As my father used to say, the night's young, and we're only 4 months almost into this administration.
Okay, so with that backdrop of my final question to you, and now you get out the Paul's crystal ball, if you will. What are some of the emerging trends or potential future shifts in employment-based health insurance that employees and employers should be aware of?
Crystal ball. So now I could be an economist and where everyone expects a prediction, but no one expects me to be right. So I would say Things like the rise of personalized and precision benefits, customizable benefits, and data-driven benefits, using claims and biometrics and digital tools to enable targeted interventions. You got precision medicine and I've just started reading about not gene therapy treatments, but genetics and how to change genetics and personalized medicine there. And I'm not sure I completely understand what I'm reading, but it just raises all kinds of questions for me of where how that fits into benefits in the future. Virtual care models maybe has gone as far as they can, but telemedicine more generally, I think, is something that kind of fits into the precision medicine space. Employers have had an interest in growing value-based and outcomes-based contracts, and I think they're going to continue to push on that. They're going to continue to reevaluate and invest in mental health benefits because they realize how, they finally got to the point where it's not just about parity anymore. They understand why it's so important. The whole weight management, obesity coverage, they're going to wrestle with what that means for them. And I think integration of health and wealth and well-being benefits is something else to look for, where employers try to take this holistic view of benefits. They're talking about it, they're thinking about it, they're tinkering with it, and that might take off. And of course, AI and what that means, I'm not sure we know exactly what it means yet, but we're going to get there pretty soon. And of course, you got to pay attention to what's happening at the regulatory level and policy shifts.
All right. Well, this has been a very informative 30 minutes for me, Paul. I learned a lot. You delivered like you're supposed to. Any final comments?
I'd say, key takeaways, future of employment-based coverage, moving towards greater personalization, accountability for outcomes, whether it's with consumers or health plans or PBMs, and integration. And the landscape is going to get even more complicated than what we're looking at. The one size fits all era, I think, is gone. And
Okay.
it's I'm you know, again, I'm so glad you asked me to do this.
Okay. Well, appreciate having you. Once again, I'm Perry Cohen. This is the second episode of Perry and Friends Conversations, and I thank you for joining us.